This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 30th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. On the show today, we hear about a new magazine that the design world has been waiting for.
There's a huge amount of talent that's just not reaching the audience it deserves to reach. So I think FIAR is about giving some of those people a platform.
Then we'll be going to Barcelona, where a building by the city's most famous architect is finally getting the attention it deserves.
Among all the buildings of Gaudí, this is the one with the longest history. It's not just one century, it's 2,400 years.
Plus, we'll get a few design insights from the world's most successful sports brand.
The old ACG obviously harkened about going up the mountain. This is way removed from that, and it's much more about survival within a cityscape.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now, avid listeners among you will know just how busy the Design Trade Fair schedule is. From Maison to Milan, IMM to ICFF, it sometimes seems like not a week goes past without a festival or fair somewhere in the world. And yet there's not one single publication dedicated to cherry-picking the best finds from each of them, which is where new mag Fiera comes in. The biannual is edited by design journalist and Confessions of a Design Geek writer, Katie Triggerdon, and I'm pleased to say Katie joins me in the studio now. So, tell us, what is Fiera about?
Fiera is a biannual independent print magazine that's focused on discovering new talent at the world's design fairs.
And where did you get the idea come from? How has this magazine, how has it not existed before? When I heard it, I was like, what a genius idea.
I was sitting on a bus on my way home from the last day of London Design Festival in the dark and the rain, absolutely exhausted, my feet throbbing, my head buzzing with ideas. And I, like ideas do, it literally just popped into my head. And I thought, there should be a magazine. Because I think what happens is you go home after that, you sleep it off, and then everybody just goes back to life as normal, as if none of that ever happened.
Mm.
And I think the coverage at the moment is mostly on social media. So it's intense and it's dynamic and it's brilliant, but it's almost as intense and dynamic and brilliant as the fairs themselves, and it disappears just as quickly.
Yeah.
So by the time the fairs are over, the coverage is all gone. And then you
and
just
it's sort of lost on an Instagram and it, feed somewhere.
Yeah. And I just felt that there was a place for something that came after that, that was able to take a step back and, yes, have some of that dynamism and that kind of, you know, excited colours and everything that you saw and that sense of passion and excitement that I feel when I go to design fairs, but also try to make sense of it and add a bit of analysis and a bit of perspective and a bit of context to that so that on reading that, you could then apply some of those things, you know, back into your day job when you go back to life as normal.
Why do you think the design industry needs this? And why has it not existed before?
I don't know why it hasn't existed before. And it's, I think sometimes the best ideas you ask that question about. Mm. And, you know, that's one of the things that every time I've mentioned it to somebody, that's been the response, which sort of gave me confidence that there might be a place for it in the industry.
Mm.
I don't know is the honest answer, but I think it's really important. A huge amount of effort goes into these design fairs.
Yep.
And I think there's a huge amount of talent and young designers who don't have PR representation yet. They don't have advertising budgets. And so they're just not getting coverage in the mainstream magazines. And, you know, they might get picked up by the blogs, but then that's disappearing. And
yeah.
I think it's rare that bloggers go to as many of the design shows as I'm lucky enough to be able to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a huge amount of talent that's just not reaching the audience it deserves to reach. So I
Absolutely.
Think FIAR is about giving some of those people a platform so that their ideas can reach the audience that they ought to be reaching.
And tell us about what's in it. What's in issue one?
So it starts with what we've called Kaleidoscope, which is everything I saw that I thought was good in colour order, which looks amazing.
Amazing.
But I'm hoping that it gives people that same experience that I had. So when you sort of go to bed at night, you have that sort of flashing of images in front of your eyes and everything that you saw and that excitement and that exhilaration. But then each of those images is assigned a code, and everywhere that design is explored in more detail, anywhere in the magazine, that code comes up again. So it gives you that kind of excitement, that exhilaration,
Rush.
But it also gives you then chance to explore in a bit more detail and sort of have it. So it kind of does what we have at the moment, but then a bit more.
Yeah.
After the kaleidoscope, the next section of the magazine is exploring those designs in more detail. So we've got interviews with designers. We've got features on how some of the products have been made, various different forms of contact that in one way or another explore those designs in more detail. We've got a photojournalism essay on some of the people behind the scenes at design fairs. So the guy on coat check, the security guard, the waitress, just kind of, again, giving it a bit of context.
Yeah.
There's another photo essay about a really amazing installation in Kortrijk, about it was in this derelict building, and it was sort of a timeline of design just with quotes and facts. So we've got another photojournalism piece on that. We also collaborated with a creative writing organisation called 26, and we asked 26 writers, we paired 26 writers with 26 new designers and asked them to write a piece of creative writing in response to that design item. We then gave those words to an illustrator who hadn't seen the original item and asked her to create an illustration. So those double-page spreads just pop up every so often throughout the magazine, a sort of a little pause and a little change of pace. And then at the back of the magazine, you've got Opinion, which is long-form essays and macro trend pieces from people within the industry, just offering some analysis, some perspective, some context. So some of the bigger themes that are coming out of the design fairs, which I think is important because so much of it is on the minutiae of, you know, this vase or that chair. And actually, this starts to look at some of the bigger themes and what that might mean for people in the design industry and how they might sort of take some of those learnings into their day jobs.
And how have you found, because people will know you for Confessions of a Design Geek, how have you found going from working in digital to doing something in print?
It's really different. I mean, obviously, I'm a freelance journalist as well, so I've written for print before.
But your own little baby.
My own little baby is a different thing, and it needs to have a different tone of voice, which has been really interesting because I write confessions pretty much as I talk. You know, people make quite a lot of the tone of voice of confessions. It's just me. There isn't a considered tone of voice. And I think that's important for blogging. You know, I think blogging has to be very immediate and very personal. I think Fiera had to have a more considered tone of voice. I like to think of it as sort of confessions big brother, slightly more serious big brother. And it had to have a slightly more analytical, slightly more considered, slightly less emotional tone of voice. And so that took a little while to get right. But it's been an incredibly enjoyable process. Absolutely love working with photographers and illustrators and other writers and Jeremy at Mad Culture on the design and all that sort of thing.
My last question is, anyone who's gone to Milan Furniture Fair will know exactly why it's called Fiera, but would you mind explaining? Because I think the name is also genius.
Whilst Fiera might be Spanish for wild beast and Esperanto for proud, it's also Italian for fair, which is the point. And I think it sums up a sense of the sort of, you know, the fun of the fair and the sort of all the stuff that goes on around, you know, just the stuff that's in exhibition halls. So it just seemed like a nice word that sort of captured the excitement that we're trying to communicate.
And how can people get a hold of a copy?
It's available on the Mad Culture shop.
Fantastic. Issue one out now. Thank you very much for coming in. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. We're going to stay in London now, but cross the city and head east to the heart of Shoreditch. Launched only a matter of weeks ago, Second Home, a shared workspace concept, is already teeming with activity and seems to be full to bursting. Central to the concept is good design, and a walk through the meandering corridors and spaces with their transparent acrylic walls reveals that this is an office like no other. Brainchild of budding entrepreneurs Rohan Silva and Sam Alderton, Second Home was designed by one of Madrid's most sought-after architectural practices, Selgas Cano. In amongst the thousands of specially selected plants and hundreds of diverse chairs and lamps at Second Home, our very own David Pleasant met architect Jose Selgas before going on to speak to Sam Alderton.
The brief was very kind of, in some point, was very simple. Yes, trying to bring a lot of different people, a lot of different companies, a lot of different ideas working together in the same space, which they wanted to be related kind of also, the feeling has to be more related to a home, kind of a sharing home space. And yeah, they got that name of Second Home in that case. So was kind of very clear at that point. It was very clear and very, very simple brief.
In our tour that you've taken part in, you've given today, the choice of material seems to be a really important feature. Maybe the most important material is this perspex or this transparency that's a theme throughout the building. Maybe describe that. I mean, we're right in the middle of these curved perspex walls. Tell us about how you use that material and why.
The problem with 300 people together working, but in different companies, in different spaces, in different things, and trying to keep that ambience and that atmosphere that you are related, that you are working in the same space. Of course, you need something that, well, for us was totally clear to work with the transparency in the space. And the most transparent material that you can have in this case is the Perspect, is the acrylic. Also, in some point, it's a cheap material. Probably the only complicated thing with the acrylic is just to find people that knows about it, that knows how to work with it. But the rest is, I mean, more or less is cheap and it's easy to, it's very flexible, so it never breaks or never, but it's the most transparent material in the world.
And finally, another key element, the furniture choices and the plants. You rather nicely describe them as people as well, like colleagues almost that you're working here with. What was that process and how, as an architect, how have you influenced these interior choices? Was that a big part of it as well, or did you hand that on to someone else, or were you kind of involved in that selection process?
Yeah, well, in this case, yes, of course, we were very involved with this, but also with the owners of the space. Also, we were working together in the selection of the pieces. Yes, of course, we are kind of people. Yeah, for us, it's clear that working with different chairs, working with different lamps, working with different also plants, so they are individual guys also, so they have their own history, they have their own date. All of them are vintage, all of them are...
So the chairs, just to explain, that's quite... Yes. There's several hundred different chairs, each one is different. Yes. What was the sourcing process? How did you do that?
Well, just...
You're rolling your eyes even trying to think about it.
I mean, we love, I mean, in that case, working also with plants is kind of the same. So we love plants, we love chairs, we love things, we love people, and it's kind of the same thing. So, I mean, working, we got the idea, you want to have that feeling of being at home. I mean, you can have the same thing everywhere. So you can have the same chairs everywhere. You can have the same lamp everywhere. So that is the kind of conventional at the end office that, I mean, your table is the same than the other guy and your lamp is the same than the other guy. And so everything is the same. In this case, if you want to give that feeling that you, more or less that you, and everything is kind of different also, but you, your place is different than the other guy working in front of you. So also, it's a problem that they are, yeah. So choosing those different types, I mean, probably is the only way to achieve that is working with the vintage things. So things that are very, very good in some point, but kind of cheap also. And also working with that feeling is the idea, I mean, that you are related also to those guys. So, I mean, you are...
The guys you're talking about, the chairs.
Of course, yeah. You are related to those guys. You are related to those lamps. I mean... So it's part of you also, it's part of your house. So, I mean, you can choose, I mean, which one you prefer or which lamp you prefer. It's kind of the idea also to move things around also, to nothing is fixed. Everything is kind of moving continuously in the space. Even the plants, even you want to move around, you want to sit around in different places, but also to bring or to change your chair because you have been sitting in another place that you love more, that chair, so you can move. So, I mean, it's kind of related also to something that is moving continuously, something is more alive.
I'm Sam Aldington and I'm the co-founder of Second Home.
Let's talk about the idea, the concept. How did it all start? What were you trying to achieve?
We set out with the aim of trying to create the best place to work. And we'd seen that a lot of small, ambitious and growing companies had really enjoyed and taken to sort of co-working environments and the energy that those places provided, but there was no natural next step for companies like that. And the idea of having your own private studio while still being around other ambitious, creative people was a really important aim. We'd also been long admirers of Selgas Kano's work, who are the architects for Second Home.
Those sort of themes in terms of workspace environments are things that maybe we have become familiar with new ways of working, sharing office space and, you know, rethinking the way the office works. But what's interesting about here is that you've respected certain key practicalities as well. So it's not all play, is it? For instance, the acoustics and things like that. You've stuck to specific, you've been quite strict in a way, haven't you? It's been a balance.
We've also thought about this deeply and spent time researching into what are the things that make people productive in their workspace. And being able to concentrate and have privacy so that you can get on with what you need to do was something at the beginning of most of the conversations we had with Selgas and Lithia. So naturally there is fun and playfulness, but it's not faux fun. There are no beanbags.
Maybe fun in terms of design and concepts, like we're leaning on, we're sitting at a what you call the flying table. It's not flying right now, but maybe tell us about this little aspect of the building or this design feature.
There's no escaping the fact that the flying table is fun, but the functional side of it is that it enables us to use the space that we're sitting in for lots of different things. And so people can work at this table throughout the day. And then in the evening, when we're adding that idea of life into the workspace, we can transform this space into a venue and have live music performances, lectures, talks. It's actually a really good example of that balance between form and function.
What do you kind of see in terms of the lifespan of this design? I mean, a lot of these temporary workspaces or conversions and kind of that whole pop-up culture has the air of the temporary about it by its very nature. There's something of the flexibility and the temporary nature to maybe the use of this space. But in terms of the design, do you feel it's a lasting product?
I think it's got a timeless quality to it and it's quite special. And I think that that will last and stand the test of time. It's also a fluid living thing where the chairs change and we rearrange the plants and we decide to put a new lamp in the foyer. It's very much like your home, you know.
Actually, can we just talk about the plants? How does it work? There's something you said, 1,000 plants in this space. How do you rotate them? How do you look after them?
There's a phrase in gardening, right plant, right place, which is an iterative thing to work out. And so we've developed something which we're dubbing the plant hospital. It's an elaborate name for a couple of greenhouses that we've got out in the courtyard. But what that enables us to do is to really play and experiment with which plant is right for which place. And that takes a lot of care and attention. So we've got two gardeners coming twice a week. It's the equivalent of 4 full days a week, arranging, moving, caring. I'm really thinking about these plants and how they survive. Probably worth pointing out also that we've adopted a hydroponic system, which is a really great way of us enabling that we get all of the right nutrients to the plant in a way that soil-based grown mediums don't allow you.
That was David Pleasant speaking to Sam Alderton at the Second Home modular workspace concept he founded in London's Shoreditch.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finish paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Sportswear stalwart Nike first launched its outdoorsy all-conditions gear range in 1989 to showcase its most technically advanced sportswear innovations to the mass market. The American multinational's latest Nightclub ACG range, however, has ditched the brightly coloured alpine-themed offerings in favour of a simpler, more urban-minded series to be released through 2015. We dispatched Monocle's edits editor, Josh Fennett, to the global launch to meet the men behind it, Errolson Hugh, co-founder of design agency Acronym, and Matthew Millward, Nike's sportswear senior design director, to see what all the fuss is about.
Today is a very important day. It marks really the relaunch of ACG for Nike, a much loved part of Nike, and also sitting with me, the very influential Errolson Hugh. I shall let you introduce yourself, but Errolson was brought in as our main collaborator for this project, a project that was pretty much very close to Mark Parker's heart, our CEO. Yeah, and today is really the launch of that collection for December.
So as you mentioned, we have Errolson here, who is a collaborator with Nike. I know it's a tough question, but I wonder if you could tell me why you think, you know, your skills were particularly suited to the task, and you know why this would have been a fruitful collaboration with Nike.
I think that stems from, as Matthew said, Mark Parker's desire to move ACG into new territory. He specifically wanted to take ACG from the outdoors and move it into the city. A lot of the work that I've done, we've done at my brand Acronym, deals with that specifically. So it was a very natural transition, and also we've known the crew at Nike for close to a decade, so it was a really natural transition to move into that.
So those people that might remember ACG for, you know, the slightly less flattering kind of mountain parkers of yesteryear, I mean, what can they, I hope that didn't sound rude, what can they expect from the new collection, and, you know, the fact that Nike has perhaps shifted its gaze onto seeing it more as a research and development tool, I don't know if that's fair to say. What can people expect from the new collection, and what's been updated?
It's certainly going to look very different. It's going to look a lot more stealth, a lot more sophisticated, much more reserved colour palette. About ACG, there was an aggression, I think, in terms of colour usage in the past. They certainly won't see the bright pops of yellow, purple and bright greens out there. And also from a silhouette perspective, it's going a lot more modern. And I think through working with Errolson and having him give his sort of input, huge input to this project, you will see a much more sort of finite, sort of sculptured handwriting to it. So it's going to look a lot of black in the palette, quite ninja-esque actually in terms of cut, quite sort of skinny cuffs and skinny hems on pants. Certainly it's going to be with an underlying sort of feeling about movement and range of motion. So it's going to be, I think sophistication will be sort of key, but still sporty. Obviously at the heart of Nike, it's all about solving for the problems of the athlete. And here it's kind of like the athlete in this more urban city metropolis. You know, the old ACG obviously harkened, you touched on it before, about going up the mountain. This is way removed from that. It's much more about survival within a cityscape and being able to be protected from all the elements the city has to throw at you.
Clearly a huge amount of work has gone into this. I was amazed to hear that a company such as Nike, which has such a venerable record for releasing trousers, was able to produce 15 prototypes of the one you guys created. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about you know, where you started with this. You mentioned in an interview you gave earlier that it was a blank canvas, but I wonder how you go about reimagining a look, and how much give and take there is, and what ideas you kind of knew beforehand and what you discovered on the way. Can you tell me a little bit about the process?
When we started this project, the first question we asked is, what could this do that could only be Nike? How do we make not just another piece of outerwear, but something that's intrinsically Nike, intrinsically ACG? And to do that, we had a lot of discussion about what's the premise, what is the value of doing it, basically trying to ask the question, why is this worth doing? And that answer to that came from the culture of Nike and the athlete. Looking at the athlete led us to come up with a concept we call the All Conditions Fit. And really that was a tool, how we constructed the pieces in terms of pattern and silhouette, but also in terms of outlook, meaning ultimately we'd like to evoke a mindset in the wearer through the physical posture of the garments.
And could you tell me a little bit more about that? Because it was one of my favorite bits about the presentation. Can you tell me how you brought that out in the items?
So getting into that, before we did any design, the first thing we did was re-engineer what's known as the fit block. The fit block in apparel is the platform. So like the chassis of a car or like the foundation of a building, it's what you build everything else onto. Normally a fit block is cut or tailored to a certain posture. That posture is normally static, meaning arms down, legs straight. Yeah, so you look good standing up and standing still. For an athlete, that's not really that advantageous, because in order for an athlete to move, you have to coil so that you can uncoil. So in order to extend, you first have to contract. So there's a precursor stance, which we call the ready stance, which is universal to many sports, that is sort of this half crouch position. So knees are bent, gravity's dropped, elbows are bent, you're looking up, and you're kind of ready to move in any direction. We decided to cut our fit block onto this stance. So it's a very, biomechanically, it's a very basic concept. contract and expand, but that's not something usually applied to tailoring. And once we started doing that, that's the reason for the 15 prototypes of the pant, because it had to have the balance between mechanics, it had to be functional in terms of range of motion, but also had to be aesthetically balanced and pleasing to the eye, comfortable to wear, project a certain image as far as silhouette, and balancing those things out was really the core of the project.
That was Monocle's Josh Fennett talking to Errolson Hugh and Matthew Millward about Nike's new all-conditions gear launch. Still to come on the show, we take a tour of one of Gaudi's lesser-known treasures. We see how architecture gets political in Istanbul, meet typographer Eric Spiekum in Berlin, and see if some Serbian architects can build a name for themselves internationally. While in Barcelona, marvelling at the works of the city's star architect Antoni Gaudi is almost mandatory. While the long lines at the Sagrada Familia may be daunting for some, a new, lesser-known Gaudi house recently opened its doors to the public. Built at the turn of the century, Torre Biesgard is one of the architect's most personal and symbolic works. While designing the private home, it was here that he developed many of the techniques that were later applied to some of his signature buildings. Our Liam Alders travelled up to the Serrer St. Gervasi foothills to take a tour with one of the new museum's cordial guides and discover this hitherto hidden architectural treasure.
Hello, Fernando.
Hi, how are you?
So this is the new Gaudi Museum?
It is. It's the less well-known building of Gaudi, but now you are going to know a little bit more about this place.
I'm nearly on the top of Barcelona's foothills in the Sarrià - Sant Gervasi neighbourhood, where I've come to visit the castle-like Torre Bellesguard. Far removed from the hordes of tourists clamouring to get inside the Sagrada Familia, this private home was built between 1900 and 1909, and only recently opened its doors to the public. It's a windy day, so Fernando and I step inside to talk about this particular location's long history.
Among all the buildings of Gaudí, this is the one with the longest history. It's not just one century, it's 2,400 years. Now there are some people studying Bellesguard and they have found, for instance, Iberian pottery from the 4th century before Christ, and after that, Roman pottery. So there is a lot of story before Gaudí. To cut off a long, long story, we can say that Bellesguard has been almost everything that a place can be, but the most important use was in 1409. Then a very important king, Martin I, lived here. He built a castle, and that castle was very important at that time. Actually, Gaudí came here because he wanted to build anything beside this castle. Nowadays, unfortunately, there are very few ruins of this castle. And the house of Gaudí is, in fact, a reconstruction of what it may have been, that castle.
Before heading upstairs, we venture back outside, out the front gate, across the road and down a small ramp, where Fernando reveals the first of many architectural secrets.
They are the famous columns that the people usually see in the Parque Güell, but the experiment was here in Bellesguard. And only people who come to Bellesguard come across this experiment.
Is this a common theme that I'm going to see, a lot of experimentation?
Yes.
Both.
When Gaudí was building Bellesguard, he was also building La Cripta Güell, and both buildings are very experimental. It's impossible to understand what comes afterwards, Casa Batlló, Pedrera and Sagrada Familia, without visiting La Cripta and Bellesguard. Bellesguard was commissioned to Gaudí by somebody called Jaume Figueres, but unfortunately this family ran out of money in 1909, so Gaudí stopped building Bellesguard at that time. For many years the house was empty until the Spanish Civil War. At that time, St. Nans came here and then transformed Bellesguard into an orphanage. Later, somebody called Luis Guilera bought the house in 1944, 1 year before the Second World War. And since then, the descendants of this Luis Guilera are living in the house. So this year is the 70th anniversary of this family living here. They are already 5 generations.
Okay, so we've just come up the steps. And one thing I've noticed, there's quite a lot of symbolism. Perhaps you can enlighten me on what those actual symbols mean.
There are many, but at least I will draw your attention to one of them. It's the rose window. This rose window is the planet Venus, which is the planet of fertility. To remember that in this place, Martin I lost all his children and also the children of his brother. All the family disappeared. And when he got married with a new queen, he died before that woman was pregnant. So it was a problem of fertility. Another paradox is that the owners of Bellaswar are gynecologists. And even Bellaswar, for a while, it was a maternity.
Well, was that a coincidence or is that just a
paradox? A paradox of history. Nobody wrote the plot here.
Okay, so we've just come into this room, which is very different to the other rooms, which are kind of a lot more ornate and covered in plaster. This room, all the brick is exposed.
Yes, because it's the unfinished part of Bellaswar. And the family who commissioned the house to Gaudí, the Figueras family, ran out of money, so Gaudí couldn't finish Bellaswar, as many other buildings of Gaudí. And the interesting thing about this room is that you can see the real structure of the house. That's why many architects come here.
It's kind of sad that the family that were going to live in this house ran out of money before it was even finished and had to move out in 1909.
And for many years it was empty until the Spanish Civil War, when it was transformed into an orphanage. And then some nuns came here with a few girls and they survived. Unfortunately, it was very cold in winter and they burned all the furniture designed by Gaudí.
That's very sad.
This is also very sad. The story of Bellaswar, it's very sad in some moments, but unfortunately now it's very cheerful and you will enjoy the visit, I hope.
Well, I'm enjoying it so far.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're just going up the stairs. Now we're pretty much on the roof, probably the highest point of Barcelona at this point because we're on top of a mountain as well. Wow, this view is spectacular.
Now you understand why Bellaswar means in Catalan, nice view.
You can see, you can even see the airport, you can see planes landing.
Yeah, you can see their traffic controller.
Wow.
You see everything. It's the best view of Barcelona.
There is a playful, yet somewhat frightening surprise on the roof. But given that his tours are based around an element of mystery, Fernando swears me to absolute secrecy. And so we head back downstairs, where we discover another playful design element in the form of an interior balcony. Thankfully, Fernando is a bit more willing to open up about this secret.
This is what you call the intercom.
Yes, because from this balcony, you can see the door of the entrance. But from the door, you don't see the balcony. If you want, you open the door, and if not, you go back to the coach in your dining room.
So it's just a way of vetting your guests. If you don't want someone to come in, you just stand on the balcony and ignore them. Or...
Well, you also must take into account that the customers of Gaudí were very wealthy people, and they wanted to surprise the guests. And the house should be full of surprises. So that they were showing the house around, they could say, look here, look there. And they say, wow. Actually, Gaudí is like an onion. It has different layers. Things are practical, they are symbolic, they are beautiful. They are related with religion, and they are also sometimes a trick.
That was our Madrid correspondent Liam Aldous visiting the Torre Bellas guardhouse building by Antoni Gaudí in Barcelona. This is Monocle 24, and you're listening to Section D. Over the past couple of years, news out of Turkey has been a complex mix of stories about urban transformation, protest movements, a booming construction sector, and deteriorating freedoms of expression and of the press. It may not come as a surprise that all these elements are connected, but how exactly they're connected is not always easy to perceive. Networks of Dispossession, a project led by Istanbul and New York-based artist Burak Arakan, combines software design, urban sociology, art, and activism to illustrate the contentious connections crisscrossing Turkish cityscapes today. The product of this project was an entrant in the Istanbul Design Biennale and has formed the basis of numerous talks by Mr. Arakan around the world. Caleb Lauer spoke with Mr. Arakan in an Istanbul cafe just across Taksim Square from Gezi Park, where the idea for Networks of Dispossession was born.
The idea is to compile data about the relationships between the capital, the private capital, and the government in the context of urban transformation in Istanbul and Turkey in general. The result of this data compiling and research work is maps, basically. These are relationship maps, not geographical maps. That means network diagrams. So what you see in these maps is, for instance, in the first map, you see the urban transformation projects happening in Istanbul and the companies who got the contract from the government. You see in these diagrams, the companies who do these projects also do other projects as well. We went out and mapped all these relationships. And we also have the value of these projects. And we use them to represent the size of the projects as bubbles in the map.
And in doing the project, what were you most surprised to learn?
I didn't know, for instance, that all the media belongs to only three companies in Turkey. This is what it is right now, all the major media, mass media. Doğuş, Doğan and Çalık. And there is Albayrak, which is smaller. And they own the major TV channels, including CNN Türk, Kanal D, NTV, Star, etc. And also the newspapers. And they completely control the mass media and mass perception, that means, you know.
So give us a sense, if you can, of how this works in practice. We were talking earlier about how the Tarlabaşa urban renewal project right next door to Gezi Park is a pretty good example of this.
So the company who's doing this transformation, this construction work, is called GAP Inşaat, GAP Construction. And the owner of this company is Çalık Holding Company. And this company owns news outlets, the biggest ones like Sabah newspaper, ATV television. I just described a single chain, like Tarlabaşı, GAP Inşaat, Çalık Holding, and let's say Sabah newspaper, you know? People who are, you know, involved in Gezi very well know that these newspaper media outlets are totally against what was happening. They were just trying to, you know, basically write about Gezi in a very negative way and in their own way, like call them terrorists or whatever, you know. And what we did also is a part of media, like it's a type of media at the end. It's a way to give information, but in a more deeper way, you know. Like while working on this project, we thought of it as a way to distribute truth, let's say, you know.
And the network maps that you've done as part of this project also illustrate dispossession that goes back decades in Istanbul and Turkey.
Yeah, the capital projects are very contemporary, you know, and then the minority map is historical, first of all. Historical because in Turkey, the roots of the ownership, especially in Beyoğlu area, ties to minorities because they were forcibly removed from Turkey. These are Armenians, Rums, Bulgarian, even Jewish people, Jewish communities who were living in Turkey. Their property is taken from them by the government forcibly, and there are documents about it and stuff like that, you know, in multiple ways, through actual force and also through the law, like, you know, new tax law about minorities. They had to pay a lot of tax, then they had to leave, you know. The Istanbul municipality, the grand municipality, owns majority, a lot of parking lots in Turkey. They run parking lots, right? And they're usually based on an Armenian graveyard. Well, many of them, yeah. You can see them in this map, actually. I mean, so it's so dramatic, you know. It's also fascistic. And so we wanted to show that, you know, next to these other current capitalist, let's say, dispossessions.
And for this project, the Networks of Dispossession project, you had some of the programming infrastructure already in place, correct?
I've been developing this platform called Graph Commons. It's an online mapping tool for network mapping, geared towards collaboration. Journalists or academics or whoever is an expert in some tool, some field, can actually bring together some data and map, do network relationship maps together. Graph Commons is like a Wikipedia, imagine it that way. But rather than editing articles, people edit diagrams. You can really collaborate in a massive sense. A lot of architecture students and architects are part of it, designers are part of it. Members, they make maps of architectural conceptual maps, like concept maps, you know, about their design or design problems and stuff like that. So some political, some design-based, some art-based, some organizational theory-based, you know, people make maps of their organization.
So in the end, this is a mix of software design, art, and activism. If you had to sum up the Networks of Dispossession project in a couple of lines, what would you say?
I see it as like a civic mapping activity and a platform where people can really use to communicate, like for solidarity as well as for really criticize the authorities in power, you know. In a way, these maps gives us multiple ways of reading the relationships of power in Istanbul. And our motivation was to actually show something invisible.
That was Caleb Lau reporting from Istanbul there. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, where we will be back straight after this.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Eric Spiekermann is a typeface legend. For the past several decades, the German designer has revolutionised typeface design, working on a revamp of Helvetica in 1983, for example, as well as corporate designs for clients like Deutsche Bahn, Audi and The Economist, to name but a few. These days, he's back to tinkering as much as he can. In his letterpress workshop on Berlin's Potsdamer Strasse, Spiekermann collects large letterpress machines and metal typefaces to get back to the basics of printing by hand, but never forgetting the advantages of technology. What is the future of typeface design, of printing, of arranging letters with your hands? How will we read in the future? Monocle's correspondent Kimberly Bradley went to meet the master in his letterpress workshop called P98 to find out.
For now, this is very much my indulgence. I had a print shop this size, which burned down in London in 77. So then I'd spent 40 years almost doing stuff on screen mainly, you know, doing corporate design and typefaces and stuff. And now I'm kind of back to where I was, where I make things by hand. And that, of course, is the trend.
The 68-year-old Spiekermann is talking about the maker trend, people yearning to break from screen-driven lives and get back to old skills, skills in which they might get their hands dirty. In this case, with lots of dark ink, metal letters in all sizes, and heavy machinery.
We did used to, you know, hold things and touch things, and like in this case, type, you would have to touch and put in position. Yeah. Physically, they were objects. Then on the screen, they're still objects, but they're kind of virtual objects, and they don't really have any presence, and you can move them around at will, and you hit return, and it moves on. Here you can't hit return. Here you have got to schlep some large pieces of metal and fill the space. In a way, what we've been doing on the screen business is almost like cooking with ready-made ingredients. You just have your package there and you mix them up and you cook them, but you don't know where they come from. Here it is like almost like killing your own chicken.
Spiekermann runs workshops with graphic design students and collaborates with designers wanting to learn the craft. He also salvages old letterpress machines, mostly German and Swiss-made, that come from larger printing companies that have moved on to new technology. Yet smaller letterpress companies are booming. Where does the trend come from?
Letterpress actually comes from, as always, from the States. And they've even made it into a word called letterpressing. But what they do there is they've rescued some of the old machines, like the old Heidelberg press that we have at the back. But they don't use the original type because that's complicated and difficult. What they do is they use polymer. In other words, they make artwork on the Mac. They send it away and have a negative made. And that negative is made into a polymer block. It used to be called a cliché.
By itself, perhaps. But it's a skill and craft worth saving, in part to remember the past physicality of typefaces we now use on screen every day.
I actually quite like this because, I mean, you know, why deny that we have computers? Which are the quality, and when I'm talking about typography, the amount of typefaces I can get, the way I can massage them, I can make really perfect typography that Gutenberg would have killed for. It is so beautiful and perfect. Why throw that away and start back to an old... This process is 500 years old, the actual letterpress. Assembling type from physical little bits of metal is crude, primitive, expensive, dirty, and heavy.
By itself, perhaps. But it's a skill and craft worth saving, in part to remember the past physicality of typefaces we now use on screen every day.
Part of the reason why I'm doing this is to preserve the craft, because it is an important craft. And the Germans invented it, and Roy Gutenberg did, kind of, and a few others. And it's important that people have those, can still know how to use those machines. These machines won't die anytime soon. I mean, look at how they were made, you know. They'll survive the next five generations. They are so heavy, these machines.
In the workshop, Spiekermann's presses are monolithic presences. Flat files are filled with sets of metal letters. Posters with funny aphorisms in large letterpress letters like, "You cannot not communicate," hang on the walls. Considering the typefaces themselves, how much has changed over the centuries?
What we call these days Roman type, or Latin type was defined in the 1470s in Venice. It's as old as that, hasn't changed. Garamond came in the 1560s. Bembo was designed in the 1460s. It hasn't changed.
Helvetica, of course, did away with serifs, taking off the last of the trimmings. What now?
You know, it goes wider and thicker because sometimes because of technology, sometimes because of individual character, sometimes because of language. Languages all look different, and typefaces go along with them. That's why English typefaces look a little different from German typefaces, even though I design, of course, for a world market. But essentially, it all serves the same human expression, so there is only so much leeway in there.
It's true you can't reinvent the alphabet. At the same time, there's no limit to tweaking typefaces. There's also plenty of room to grow in terms of the typeface market as media interfaces evolve.
Right now we're shifting media, obviously, that, you know, up to, well, to for some 25% of all web pages already use other than system fonts. So that, in other words, 75% of all websites, in other words, millions and billions of websites in the world are still using system fonts. So these people are still in the market, potentially, to improve the appearance of the websites.
And what gadgets might we read these websites and typefaces on? Again, Speakerman sees a current confluence of technology and tradition, but it all comes down to humans, analog beings that we are.
The small screens are getting bigger, the big screens are getting smaller. You know what? It's going to end up looking like a book. Because you know what? We found out 500 years ago the book is an optimal size, that you can hold it arm's length and it's, you know, so the sort of iPad is pretty much the optimal size. You can't, if you go bigger than this, it strains your arms. You go smaller, it strains your eyes. Duh. There's a form factor that the good old book.
Gutenberg would have been proud. For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
And you can read more about Eric in The Forecast, Monocle's new annual magazine, which is out now. And to end the show, we're going to head to Belgrade. Serbia is home to a real mixed bag of architectural styles. Centuries of invasion and destruction have left it with concrete reminders of the Ottoman, Habsburg and communist eras. But for the past three decades, there's been very little development. The breakup of Yugoslavia, international embargoes and economic woe have seen to that. But now, Serbia's on the road to European Union membership, and there are signs of movement, at least in the capital. There are new bridges, a massive and controversial development on the riverfront, and a new hotel going up in the old town. Plus, six Serbian projects have been nominated for the Mies van der Rohe Award, the EU Prize for Contemporary Architecture. So, is this the dawn of a new architectural era? Monocle's man in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay, went to meet one of the award nominees, Milan Juric of DFA Studio.
If you want evidence of the influence of architects on Belgrade, then you just have to come here to New Belgrade. This was an absolutely massive project at the end of the Second World War, one of the most radical building efforts ever seen in Europe. It's also where you'll find one of Serbia's nominees for the Mies van der Rohe Prize, the Nikola Tesla Science of Life Kindergarten. Like its surroundings, it's concrete, but there are fresh touches here. There are curves as well as cubes, bringing a fresh feeling to this concrete jungle. And that's exactly what its designer had in mind, architect Milan Juric of DVA Studio in Belgrade.
It's some kind of other view on local architecture. It's some kind of step not forward, but some kind on the right or the left, on the side, from the usual Serbian practice.
When you're saying it's in New Belgrade, it fits in with New Belgrade, but there are some things which are different about it. What are those key things which make it different from just this expanse of concrete, which can be quite overwhelming?
And why is the problem with the concrete? New Belgrade is, for architects, some kind of best thing in contemporary architecture in the last 40, 50 years in old Yugoslavia architecture.
Serbian architects have seen the lean years stretch into decades. The last true signature building was the Genex Tower, and that was built more than 30 years ago. Symbolically, that construction is now in a terrible state. But Serbia is moving towards a new era of European Union membership, and it could be time for a fresh start for its architects as well.
Profession in Serbia is in a problem. It's not simply definition of architecture and architectural profession in the differences, for example, with the UK. it's a problem of try to find some kind of real professional models for work.
So in other words, you think there needs to be sort of a signature style of Serbian architecture?
Why? No. I think it's not simply to define that. It's a lot of influences, I think it's some kind of roughness. I think here is a key.
Unpolished?
Unperfect and unfinished.
Is it something to be proud of?
I think it's okay.
At least architecture is back in people's conversations thanks to some controversial mega-projects, the Abu Dhabi-funded Belgrade waterfront and a Zaha Hadid project further along the River Sava, plus a new hotel at the heart of the city's historic old town. There's still plenty of scepticism that these projects will come to fruition.
I think it's a picture now, you know.
So it's not a reality, it's just...
I think now is a picture. We see what's going on in the next few years, but I think now it's a picture. It's a media pictures.
Mm. So in other words, all these images we've seen in the media of these amazing sort of free-flowing shapes with the Beko Zaha Hadid project or this enormous tower on the banks of the Sava and Danube and the Belgrade waterfront project. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Is it actually going to happen?
I don't think so. I think it's a floating global architecture. It's not well connected with the place, and then it's well connected with the contest. It's a different kind of architecture.
Even so, it seems there is, or soon will be, funding for architecture in Serbia again, and it seems the younger members of the profession should be well prepared.
We are focused here on education of architects. It's time for education because not a lot of job, but it's a time for a focus on education for the next generation. It's okay. And I think it's a next generation of architects. Next generations are being well connected with everything what's going on.
So it could be a few years before we discover what the next wave of Serbian architecture will look like. We've had the Ottoman, Habsburg and communist eras. Stand by, perhaps, for the new European. For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
And that's all we have time for in today's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and to play you out, we have the very Serbian sounds of Goran Bregovic with Ringa Ringa Raya. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.